I think that's still an attractive goal. Why not? I mean, if as a person I want to understand something and find the truth, but the question is, how do you really get to the truth? You know, so
is there one truth?
Also, good question. No, I mean, we're in philosophy here.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our next episode of About Logic, our little podcast. And I'm super happy that Deborah Kant joined us this time for many, many reasons. She just published a lovely book based on her PhD study that was awarded by the DVMLG. We are longtime collaborators, so we organized an event together where Thorsten and I also met. So maybe this whole channel wouldn't exist without her. And she does lovely stuff. So I'm very happy that you accepted and offer us a little time to talk about the foundations of set theory.
I'm very happy to be here with you.
Great. Can I very naively invite you to give us a few sentences? What are you working on? Maybe I should mention you are now at the Freie Universität Brussels. So we nearly met there, but...
Right.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I'm now in Brussels because my expertise is especially on mathematical practice, and Brussels is a great place to work on this with very nice colleagues there. And yeah, actually, I changed a bit my path. I started with mathematics and was interested in set theory because the notion of truth gets challenged very quickly when you go into set theory. And then I turned for the PhD to philosophy to understand more broadly what's happening there. And yeah, that's how I came to do set theoretic practice. And I gathered a lot of data about set theoretic practice, and that's what I'm still working on and getting a more complete picture of what's happening there.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting. Would you give us like a very short recap about this huge study you did with set theorists when you interviewed them?
I can do this. So this was a few years ago. I just wanted to understand. So the starting idea was to understand the notion of naturalness in set theory, because if you start thinking about the axioms and the independence problem in set theory, so that you have questions that you cannot answer based on the standard axioms that you have established right now, you start wondering how to maybe add more axioms, if this is possible. So that's an open philosophical question that I was interested in. And one idea is to add natural axioms. So people also in the literature, like one could say Gödel and others, suggested this path to add natural axioms. And that's what brought me to set theoretic practice, because if you work out a definition or an account, what is naturalness, I thought it should be consistent or reflective of what set theorists really find natural. And so this developed. And in the end, I said, okay, I just do a real interview study and ask them a lot of questions. So different set theorists from different research areas within set theory. So almost 30 participants in the study. And I asked them about how they work with new axioms, with the standard axioms, with the method of forcing, which is very central in set theory, because you prove that a statement is independent by building different models, one in which the sentence is true and one in which the sentence is false. And this technique of forcing is enabling you to do this. So how do they work with this method? And then also about how they interpret this whole situation of set theoretic independence, of the existence of these sentences where you don't know whether they are true or false.
Can you not explain maybe this phenomenon of independence? Also a bit of historic note here. I think we're going to see Dana Scott. I think he was also involved to give another proof of independence of the continuum hypothesis. Can you say a little bit about what this is all about?
Yeah, maybe we should start with Cantor then in the 19th century, because he was asking about the continuum hypothesis. And so very quickly, the question there is about the size of the real numbers, because Cantor also proved that you can have different sizes of infinite sets. And mm-hmm. then the first infinite sets, the natural numbers, is the first size of infinity. And then you can have other sizes. And the question about the continuum hypothesis is where is the size of the real numbers situated in this hierarchy of infinities? And so Cantor wanted actually to prove it, but later with the axiomatic approach, people became more aware of which axioms you use to prove something, and then they started to build models of a certain set of axioms. And then they found out with Gödel's result about the constructible universe L, and later with Cohen's results about a model in which the continuum hypothesis is false, so which gives another answer than the model L mm-hmm. that Gödel constructed, to say, okay, so you have a set of axioms, but you can add the continuum hypothesis or the opposite proposition, and you can get a consistent model.
Mm-hmm. So what does it tell us, actually? I mean, is there actually one right answer for the continuum hypothesis? Or to me, I mean, it seems to be that sets are, I mean, I think the question is there something like sets, like the ideal sets? And personally, I wouldn't accept this. I think maybe there are different conceptions of what sets are. And in some, the continuum hypothesis holds, and in others, it doesn't.
So that's one very possible and very also probable answer. I think there's good evidence in favor of that answer, to just say, okay, now we have these different models, and this seems to show that what we understand by a set is not something sufficiently determinate so that we can answer questions like this. So if you want to ask about my personal opinion, that's a bit
okay,
I'm
yeah.
still developing it. Yeah. So yeah. Also in my PhD, it was not about to find a right answer to this question, but first to understand what's happening there, what's actually the problem. So one goal was to pin down what's going wrong. And yeah, one interesting thing I found out, that even the practitioners are very, they have very different opinions on these matters. And that was, for me, an unexpected result, to see that they don't have a consistent or a consensus on this matter.
Yeah, people in sets, or my impression was, many people in set theory, they want to have some sort of, not complete, we know because of Gödel, but as complete as possible set of axioms. Whereas I think I like weak theories, because weak theories are more, they apply in more situations. I mean, if you have fewer axioms or fewer principles, then whatever you prove is applicable to lots of different interpretations. So I'm in favor. I mean, obviously I'm not a set theoretician. I do type theory, which is in a sense much weaker, but I think that's a feature and not a bug, you know.
So maybe I could say two things about this. So one attractive feature of having a lot of axioms is to go along with the idea that in mathematics you ask a question and then you can just say, okay, that's true or it's false. So any question you answer, you can just answer it. And so a lot of people, when they turn to mathematics, they have this idea now that actually you just get an answer to your questions.
Yes.
And so that's attractive about having a lot of axioms. But still, what you mentioned, so I would interpret this as a practice, the mathematical practice, a specific one that is also used in set theory. So to work with very weak axiomatic systems, also to maybe learn about the subtleties of the problem, because if you have like very powerful axioms, that's a bit broader as a method to solve your question. So that's still valuable. And I think also set theorists see value in using weak systems.
Maybe to follow up on this view that Thorsten elaborated, is there really one conception of set? I mean, there is a model theoretic counterpart to that question, right? Which would be universalism versus multiverse view. Is there, I mean, whenever you want to share your personal views, of course, feel free. But I'm also, of course, asking about the views that you heard, the question whether there is a consensus, whether there is a clear division. Is there anything you could elaborate on that? Is set theoretic practice mostly one, the other, or?
Yeah. So maybe again, two things on this. So in my PhD work, I was a bit reluctant to address these issues in these ontological terms, because that's philosophically more difficult, I think. Also to justify ontological statements like sets exist, or there's a universe, or there's a multiverse. But actually then when I spoke to different set theorists, so at least the universe view by practitioners who were really in favor of we have to find true new axioms, they often articulated their view in ontological terms. So that they really believed there is a unique universe of sets, and what they're doing is to describe this universe and to find out what's true in this universe. And then other practitioners who were more in the pluralist camp, so who said actually ZFC or ZF is an already very powerful theory, and it's sufficient to work with this theory we have. We don't need new axioms. They were not so much formulating their view in terms of a multiverse view, but just to say we have these models, we build these models, that's what we do, and there's not one of these models which stands out as being more correct than the others.
So what is this multiverse versus universe view? Can anybody enlighten me?
So the universe view just says that ZFC is the starting point for the standard theory of set theory. And actually you have, like you have for the natural numbers, an intended model. So one universe of sets, the V. V is the class of all sets. And people don't know what it is right now, but the idea that one such determinate universe exists, which can be described axiomatically, that's a universe view. And the multiverse view, most prominently defended or proposed by Joel Hamkins, is the contrary, to say there's not just one such universe, but actually the ontological basis of set theory is a multiverse where or which encompasses like all the models that you can build in set theory.
Okay, to me it seems that what we call set is I mean, I think that's close to what you're doing is the result of mathematical practice and sort of intuition, which is then turned into axioms, and I would say. That's all there is. There isn't anything else. I mean, personally, I find ZFC far too strong because it has some principles which I don't understand. I mean, which is I have a completely different intuition. So it's ZFC. I mean, for two reasons. I mean, obviously axiom of choice, which I don't understand, and. Also has power sets, which I think are too much. I mean, for me, the collection of propositions isn't small; it's large. But I guess that's outside of your area of interest, yeah.
So, if we turn to practice what I really like and think is good for philosophy or philosophy mm-hmm. of mathematics to turn to practice. We can look to set theoretic practice to understand what are sets or what a set theory about. But we could also look, but that's not what I did. We could also look into general mathematical practice. And that's maybe more or closer to your viewpoint or your perspective on these matters. So of course you would find many different viewpoints there. But already I just considered set theoretic practice and already there I didn't find consensus agreement and like one idea of what sets are. So that's, yeah, already interesting. But of course, the axiom of choice, for example, was not very controversial, or it's just part of the standard axioms. So you don't find in set theoretic practice views like we should use weaker systems or we should try to avoid the axiom of choice. I mean, in some areas, people are very interested in definability, and then they like to use some other principles which are not consistent with choice, like the axiom of determinacy. But they just use these things in proofs or working and trying to get to proofs. So then, for these reasons, they avoid AC in some methods they apply, but not in a general, very foundational matter.
Yeah, I mean, one consequence of choice is that you lose the possibility of having a constructive interpretation. I mean that you construct. I mean that you want that all functions which that's what I want, coming from computer side, that all functions I construct are actually effective. I can compute them. And choice in a fundamental way destroys this. And I don't think that, I mean, I think it's very a very nice situation to be in, especially if you apply mathematics in for computer science. And actually, I think that if you watch the practice, or if you look at the practice, there are more and more people using now systems like Lean to formalize mathematics, which is based on type theory. It also usually assumes choice, but I think you can observe that in most what people do, they don't actually need it. It's like a habit. It's like maybe, or like a drug addiction.
There are certainly advantages in not using choice, and that's very legitimate.
I mean, there is one thing where not using choice has no advantage, and this is equiconsistency, right? Tobira, you know more about it probably. But ZF and ZFC are equiconsistent, which means that if one is consistent, so is the other, right? So
yeah.
So maybe on that, is consistency something that still worries people in this search for axioms, or is that an old issue that's not relevant anymore?
So it's philosophically puzzling, but it was with Gödel, since he said, okay, we can't prove it, so we have to believe it somehow or get another kind of evidence. And certainly in the beginning, when people were researching more axioms beyond ZFC, like very powerful axioms, there was some worry about consistency, but that's not really the case anymore. So people started to look into large cardinals. So that's one kind of new axioms that you could add to ZFC beyond Reinhardt cardinals. So Kunin proved at some point that if you add a very large cardinal axiom that's inconsistent with the axiom of choice, so that's very close to being worried about consistency. And he said, okay, here we have an actual inconsistency. But today, people are even going beyond this. So they drop AC and then look into stronger assumptions, which shows that, I mean, they don't believe that these are consistent immediately, but they are confident enough about the lower ranks to say, let's look into these new concepts. Maybe there's some value in it.
Yeah. This is not also, I mean, I always feel that foundations should be rather weak because then you can intuitively understand them and accept them. So I'm a bit puzzled about this idea that you want something very strong, which I find, which I intuitively find hard to understand or accept. Yeah. So instead of having strong foundations, also have weak foundations, and then you can go in different directions, right?
I mean, are we necessarily still in the foundation domain? Maybe that's also a question. Because if I just want to understand higher infinities, I might look at systems for higher infinities, even if they aren't foundationally necessary.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a good point you mentioned, that looking into these new axioms or these very strong principles can also be considered as a as an interesting project, just to investigate these principles and what you can do with it without having the goal of suggesting any of them as a foundation for mathematics. You can also consider this as a very inner set theoretic program to find out axioms just for set theory, for example.
Maybe I'm prompting you to say more and more about your study. I mean, in the end, you should read the book if you want to know all there is to know. Can I ask very naively, is there any fun fact, any super surprising thing that you would like to share with the audience from your studies besides the lack of consensus that you already mentioned?
Yeah, maybe one surprising thing was that's relating to this lack of consensus on the philosophical issues was to find out that if you look into the naturalness judgments or maybe more generally, so that's still in a hypothesis, but that's a topic in the mathematical practice discussion on the extent to which people agree on such value judgments. And I found that there's more agreement on these judgments, on what they find natural. So, for example, that they usually think the Suslin hypothesis is not a very natural object to exist. So I can't give evidence for complete consensus there, but in comparison to this disagreement on the philosophical views, there's much more agreement there. And that's that led me to the hypothesis that maybe that's very important in practice, how people agree and communicate via these naturalness or value judgment, or if a problem is deep or a result is very exciting or something. That's from the viewpoint of mathematical practice, very crucial.
Maybe we can explain a few things. I mean, we already mentioned axiom of choice, which we didn't actually explain. And now you mentioned the Suslin hypothesis. Can you expand this a bit?
Yeah, so that's the second example besides the continuum hypothesis for an issue that is open. You have the characterization of a Suslin line, which is the mathematical definition, which is very close to the definition of real numbers. There's just one small difference there. So it's almost the same object as the real line, a Suslin line, but it's you can have a model where a Suslin line is not the real line. So you have really something that is different from the reals. And that's what people find not so natural to exist.
So you meant, when you say the reals, you meant the Sof-Dedekind reals
yes.
As defined, yeah?
Yes. So in set theory, also a usual definition is just to think about the power set of the natural numbers. And in topological terms, you have the topological definition with density and completeness.
So if Thorsten, if you don't want to ask for a concrete set theoretic question, maybe I would like to switch focus a little bit, but
okay,
you should.
So actually, I've got one question. And to me, I mean, coming from type theory, I find always set theory actually a bit weird from point of mathematical practice. I mean, when I say, if I say for all numbers m and n, m plus n equals, or for natural numbers, m plus n equals n plus m, then that's what I mean, right? I'm only talking about natural numbers. Whereas in set theory, you basically say for all x, y, which are sets and which turn out to be element of natural numbers, this is rather a bit of a strange idea, right? Why would I have to quantify over all sets if I only want to talk about natural numbers?
I don't think that, yeah, maybe that's an open question. If you turn to practice, if that's such a subtlety that you could investigate. So you have bounded quantifiers also in set theory, and if they're bounded by the natural numbers, that's yeah, a simple formula, and you just talk about the natural numbers.
Yes. I mean, as I contrast this with type theory, there I introduce types and I talk about elements of types. So I would never have to talk about all things, but I always talk about the things I actually mean.
You never need unbounded quantifiers, you mean?
No.
Yeah.
And the other thing which I puzzles me, or which I find a bit strange, is in set theory, when you introduce a set, like a set of natural numbers, and so the standard definition from Neumann, every number is a set of all smaller numbers. So that's a particular encoding of natural numbers. That's actually not relevant. I mean, I really mean the natural numbers. I shouldn't really, I mean, in set theory, you can ask strange questions, like is 2 a subset of 3? Which doesn't really make any sense. And then you could, okay, and people... Okay, I'll leave you to answer it. But people tell me, okay, yeah, but we don't do this. But it means that you're never sure. I mean, people use representations sometimes to have elegant proofs, and you never know whether a theorem is actually about numbers or whatever concept you have, or the particular encoding. Do you see what I mean?
So. Yeah, again, I can just say that I think these subtleties are not something you can investigate and practice. So, because this is about formalization, about the formalization of your mathematical practices. So, if you look into what people do in the practice, you couldn't like study which formalization they always use in their proofs, because this is much too detailed. You can, of course, compare, I think, what you did, the formal language that is based at the foundations of set theory and of type theory, so the use of different formal languages. But that's not a very practical question anymore. That's not about practice. That's about the formal foundation.
Okay, so first of all, I don't necessarily mean it's formal, right? I think that if you think about in the sense of type theory, even if you don't formalize it, you have a different view of mathematical constructions, and that's pre-formal. That's just what intuition you use. I think of types. And actually, if you go back to Cantor, Cantor, in a way, he introduced, I don't know whether he was the first one, introduces in German Mengen, right? And which we could say abstractly collections in a way. He certainly emphasized this. And then he said a set is something given by a property, right? So the sets and properties are sort of identified. Do you agree
with this? That's what Frege said, yeah.
Yeah. But isn't it Cantor already who said a set is given by a property? Yeah, right.
I think he was very open then also to mm-hmm. having sets that are not defined by a property. But
oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, so interesting. And then I mean, but then if you use pure set theory, then you say property of what, and you say property of sets, right? A set is a property of sets in pure set theory, and if you look at this equation, it's obviously it's a negative what we call in computer science a negative domain equation, which is inconsistent, which is basically Husserl's paradox, right? So an alternative is, instead of, and you say Cantor didn't actually do this, so I blame the wrong person, to identify sets with properties, to say, okay, let's just say what are collections, or how can we form collections, right? Which is the type theoretic approach.
I mean, I cannot say too much about the comparison to type theory because I'm not sufficiently into the motivations and intuitions, but I mean, I was thinking about these, and I heard also like people talking about the attraction of type theory. Maybe very generally, I just think that from your viewpoint, it's maybe comprehensible that there are some attractive questions to be asked in set theory, and maybe the practice is very different, or it works with very different methods that from the viewpoint of type theory are not very attractive or really like weird. But still, the questions the set theorists are interested in are much more, of course, than thinking about how we formalize questions about natural numbers. So that's not sure. Why they do set theory.
Sure. No. I mean, I just want to clarify that type theory is not only about formalization, but it's
no,
a different
that's not
way
what
to
I
think. Right?
Meant to yeah. say, mm-hmm. of course, yeah.
Yeah, and actually, as you say, often you find an interesting parallelism in that questions which occur in set theory show up in type theory and vice versa. So it's why they are quite different in the basic intuitions. There are, in some case, there's lots of possibility to lots of connections between the views. So you don't, in a way, as a philosopher, you don't question mathematical practice. You're more observing it. Is this a fair description?
At this point, yes. I'm observing and trying to understand how mathematicians deal with the things that I find philosophically puzzling. So that's the first step to better understand these puzzling things about independence and set theory.
So maybe this is the ideal bridge to the other big topic I wanted to ask you about. So allow me, like, there are two chauvinistic hats that I could wear, and one is maybe the hat of why do we even talk with mathematicians? Why should they know anything? Shouldn't a real philosopher just think about it and get it right, so to speak? What does their opinion matter? So maybe this is the philosophy first hat, to use that name, right? There are these two schools of philosophy. You mentioned philosophy second. So first look at the things, they have some kind of priority, and then you can develop something out of it. And then there are philosophers who say, I don't care about practice, just make it right, and then they should learn from me how to reorganize mathematics, so to speak. You probably are in camp two, right? And we also published on that, why you should be in camp two. But can you tell us a little bit about this? Have you met philosophers disregarding your results, maybe even, or how is the landscape?
I think that's a very traditional view you're raising there, with this, the philosopher has to get it right and just on himself find the solution, or by himself. I think that's still an attractive goal. Why not? I mean, if as a person I want to understand something and find the truth, but the question is, how do you really get to the truth? You know, so
is there one truth?
Also, good question. No, I mean, we're in philosophy here. There are questions where you hope there's just one answer. There are questions where you know you can't give like one definite answer. That's a very simple response to this. But I think in mathematics, it's really difficult to disregard what's going on, because mathematicians, as we also wrote together, Dennis, in our paper, they have so much expertise on their subject that philosophers lack, that it's hard to really get to the heart of the matter, I think, from an independent point of view that disregards what's happening in mathematics. I think the probability is just higher that you get to philosophical answers that are just wrong because they don't take into account what's going on in the mathematical area. And actually, because you were asking about people reacting to my research, of course, there are a few voices which are still skeptical about such research and do prefer to give direct answers to philosophical questions and not first look into the practice and then maybe propose an answer. But I always consider this to be a challenge to explain the relevance of the research and, of course, to build bridges because, like the sociological research I did, is methodologically very different from what philosophers are used to. So I also see this as a task for me to explain the relevance and the method and what's going on in this kind of research and what is it contributing to the philosophical discussion. And then to build a dialogue and see how things are working out.
May I maybe have a less chauvinistic head and follow up on that? When you speak with mathematicians, they focus on different things than philosophers. Is there like a big challenge to really get out what you want to know, so to speak, from them? Like a toy example, maybe not for set theorists, but for a lot of mathematicians, provable and truth are the same thing, right? Because normally you can prove every true statement, so it's interchangeable, because set theorists are aware of this distinction. Is there any nuanced philosophical content where you kept getting a category mistake as the reply, so to speak?
Yeah, maybe I cannot answer this very generally, because also practitioners are formulating their things in different words, no? But for example, in my interviews, I try to avoid misunderstandings, of course, but I couldn't be 100% sure. And one confusion was when I asked about the search for new axioms. So I was asking the participant, what do they think about the search for new axioms? And one of them was answering, yes, and since the incompleteness theorems, we know this is very important, and I really like this search, and we have to do this. And then it turned out, because the interview developed beforehand, that this person had actually a pluralist view. So the answer was not to say we have to find new true axioms, but it was just we have to investigate all these new axioms. So things like this happen when you go into practice. And I thought that interviews are a good method to avoid misunderstandings like this and to get the right interpretation of what they mean by what they describe about their practice. Yes. But of course, you have to find one transparent, explainable way of interpreting what's happening in the practice.
Okay, can I?
Yeah, sure.
So, because you said people are looking for tools, that's a certain perception of mathematics. I mean, in my view, reflects the sort of naive, sort of Platonic view that says that mathematical objects are basically there and they're discovered. Whereas I prefer to view mathematics as sort of storytelling, and that the question of truth is not really the right question. The question is for what can you deliver evidence? What's your view on this? Does this has any impact on the way you view mathematics?
Yeah, truth is a very good example for this difficulty between doing philosophy and then mathematical practice. And philosophers are also divided on this. So like Penelope Meddy, who has worked a lot on set theoretic practice, she's also open to the view that we should not talk about truth at all, just about the methods that are successful in practice. That's how set theory works. So also as a philosopher, one could say we don't want to talk about mathematical truth. I still think then a philosopher should give a good explanation of what math is about if it's not about mathematical truth. But that's feasible. And the mathematicians themselves, I think that in common or usual language use, the notion or the word true is still used in the sense of we found out that's true and that's not true, mm-hmm. and things like this. So it's for someone interested in the practice, it would be a bit of a challenge to interpret this way of talking in a different way to avoid truth. But that's also a thing you could do, but you would have to find a solution of how to interpret this in that case. And of course, if you ask set theorists or mathematicians maybe more generally about truth, then so that's what I experienced in my interviews also, they sense that there's a deeper philosophical meaning that they don't want to touch. And then they don't want to pin down what actually is mathematical truth. And I think, Dennis, you're right that provability and truth is often the same thing and the usual language use.
Yeah, I would say provability. I would say evidence, right? Something for which I have evidence, I accept, right? So that's, I mean, this is this idea, as I say, of storytelling. And in a story, you don't have truth, but you say, of what I've heard before, I have evidence that such and such holds.
And conclusive evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, some whatever you mean by evidence, you don't have to nail it down, right? But that's the idea. And in my view, I always find it. I find mathematicians. I mean, it's a particular. I mean, I think in sociology, there's a particular idea, a doctrine in mathematics, which is not usually questions by mathematics. It's a sort of like almost a process of brainwashing, from my view. Because I don't find that the sort of mainstream ideology of mathematics is a very good one for my sort of philosophical point of view. And I find it always surprising that philosophers sort of unquestionable just follow what this mathematic ideology is. And instead of not telling them what to do, but telling them to explain better what they mean, right? And instead of just looking what they do. I mean, I'm in a different community where constructions are, in type theory, which are based on this sort of intuitionistic perception that mathematics is actually constructed, which I think is very natural. I think hard to disagree with this. But this has consequences. Once you accept this idea, this has consequences of how we do mathematics.
I think it's not the task of the philosopher to be absolutely quiet about mathematical practice and just license everything what's happening there. Of course, they can point to incoherences, to vaguenesses, to ideas that are misleading, to things like this. I think it's not fruitful that the philosopher demands a lot of the mathematician to satisfy actually the philosopher's goals, like having a clear picture of what math is about. So
But isn't it the question that they should? I mean, the mathematicians they just say, okay, we have this truth, and mathematical objects are like real objects. That's a certain metaphor. But once we question this metaphor and ask them to explain really what they mean, then we may end up with a different perception of mathematics.
I don't think that every mathematical practitioner is really like a strong Platonist in this sense.
Yeah, I mean, lots of them, that's true. Lots of them, they just like to ignore this question, right? They just say, we'll just do something and we don't question it. But that makes it maybe difficult to explain to other people what they're doing and why they're doing it, right? So that's the interface. I mean, once you are introduced to this mathematical belief system, then you just accept it and you don't ask anymore. But there is this, there is this like outside world and people who learn mathematics and so on. And maybe they should, in many cases, they need a better way to explain what the whole thing is about. It's not so much a philosopher, it's rather the naive practitioner or the naive person who is interested in mathematics. But
that's certainly good here if mathematicians can explain well what their subject is about and maybe also question and a bit of self-reflection there.
So is there anything that you would really like to share with the audience? Or otherwise I would say thank you. Is there anything that came up?
Well, it's a very urgent? Interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Anything urgent from you, Thorsten?
Thank you very much. No, that was good to hear it. Hope to see you again.
Yeah, so let me also say thank you very much for this really lovely chat and the insights into your big study and other work and the relation of math and philosophy. So let me then have like the final moment for another kind of brainwashing, and that's the brainwashing of the audience. Please subscribe, comment, press the like button and do whatever else you can do to support the channel. It's a lovely
and tell
work
your friends.
We would.
And tell your friends.
Yeah, exactly. Great. So much
thank
from us
very
this
much,
week.
Thorsten and Dennis.
Deborah,
nice
I hope you also
here.
Advertise.
Okay. Then bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.